Hello. Welcome to our podcast, Blethers With, which accompanies our textbook, Criminal Justice in Scotland, published by Routledge. This episode is a blether with James Smith, a criminal defence solicitor specialising in legal representation for prisoners during parole hearings. In the conversation, Katrina Morrison talks to James about the parole process, the role of legal representation in parole hearings, and the complex challenges that affect prisoners during this process, progression within the prison system, risk-averse decision-making, and increasingly onerous licence conditions. Just a quick content warning, the episode includes a brief mention of domestic violence around the 21-minute mark. This episode accompanies Chapter 10 of the book, but you're welcome to listen to it on its own. Either way, thanks for listening.
James, thank you so much for making time out of your incredibly busy schedule to chat with us for the Blethers podcasts. I suppose as a first question, for people who don't know what a parole solicitor is, how would you explain what you do?
I suppose I'm a criminal defence solicitor, and over time I've gravitated into dealing with not only people going into prison, but those coming out of prison. So a parole solicitor is a solicitor who assists individuals who have reached the appropriate point in their sentence to be considered for release on licence. And my function really is to assist in them in understanding the process and help them, I suppose, make representations to the parole board as to what they wish to do, whether that is to seek their release or not seek their release and seek a particular review period. And it's really just to guide them through the process and understand the process that needs to be gone through whilst having, I suppose, one eye on the law surrounding it.
Yeah, absolutely. Do people go through parole or apply for parole without a parole solicitor or without a criminal solicitor supporting them? And I suppose what's the benefit of having a solicitor present in that situation? And do you think that people who don't have a solicitor are adversely affected, I think, as a result?
There are, I imagine, a number of people who go through the process unrepresented. I couldn't tell you how many. The parole board are very good at least if they are oral hearings, encouraging people to seek legal representation for the oral hearing. But it's sort of, there is a casework meeting process which is essentially done on the papers only and with written representations, and I don't know how many people maybe go through that process themselves. I also don't know how many people sort of self-reject from the process also. But you do meet people through the process who have maybe in years gone by self-rejected or turned up themselves because they didn't necessarily feel that they were ready for the purposes of release, or it wasn't something that they wanted, or they don't necessarily want to be released and be on licence in that sense. Mm-hmm. So there are people who do it that way. In the main, I think you may find that those who genuinely want to give it a good shot instruct a solicitor to assist them. And I think that on the face of it, it doesn't look complicated to ask for parole, but it is extremely complicated. Primarily because the board have three legal tests that apply to three categories of prisoners, and therefore you've got to make sure you're addressing the correct legal test. And each legal test has a little bit of a nuance as to, I suppose, the weight of risk that needs to be sort of applied, or how to put it. I suppose if you sort of put it as a bar that you've got to cross. Some bars are lower, I think, for each legal test, in my view. Whether that's right, I don't know. But in my view, I think there is. There's a different nuances to each of them. So I think that it's helpful to have somebody assist. I think that if you have somebody assist in terms of just preparing some representations, I encourage all my clients to write their own representations, essentially from the heart in that sense. Mm-hmm. But it allows me to mm-hmm. write representations as a lawyer, as in this is what's missing, this is what we need, this is what you should consider, these are the positives, these are the negatives, this is why the legal test is met. And I do think that, I think in some cases, people are successful as a result of the intervention of the solicitor. In many cases, I don't necessarily think it makes a difference, particularly in the circumstances where somebody is maybe not being released. I think it's sometimes difficult to make an argument, but you have to try to do so. So, from that point of view, I think it does make a difference, and I think that it's worth people instructing a solicitor to help them.
And, you know, it's their right after all, isn't it? And then it's up to the parole board. So you mentioned three different categories of prisoners and three, and therefore three different legal tests. What are they briefly?
Well, you'll have a determinate sentence prisoner who has essentially has a date on the door, in the sense, no matter what happens, they're getting released. And the legal test for release in respect to them is essentially what risk does this individual present, and can those risks be safely managed in the community? You then have extended sentence prisoners who, when they are recalled to custody, the legal test changes, and it changes to whether it's necessary for protection of the public from serious harm that they be confined. And so there's important distinctions to be made, because once they are in the extended part of their sentence and once they are recalled to custody, the presumption essentially is in favour of release, because they are only in custody for the purposes of public protection, and they're not in the prison for the purposes of punishment at that stage. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that's why for an extended sentence, getting an extended sentence, you have to exhibit that you are at risk of serious harm, but equally so to be, which is quite a high bar in one view, but on release, you have to demonstrate that you're not at risk of serious harm and that serious harm's not imminent, etc. And I suggest that that's a fairly low bar to actually transition out back into the community, because it requires you to be a serious harm, which means that they're looking for, like, if you're talking about violence, you're looking at sort of really significant violence rather than mm-hmm. just a sort of a small assault or a breach of the peace or a theft or something like that. There might be a risk that you might be non-compliant, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to cause that level of harm. So from that point of view, it's where there's often a good argument as to why people should be re-released in those circumstances. And then you have life prisoners who have legal test of whether it's necessary protection of the public to be confined. I have a particular view of the legal test. It's not been disabused by anybody, but essentially it means it is the board rightly to consider whether it is the individual is a substantial or significant risk of serious harm. And the court has seemed to indicate that it's the sort of violence that the individual received a life sentence for. So if you've got a life sentence for murder, you're looking at sort of considering, are they going to cause that level of violence? Are they going to commit another murder? I concede in my submissions to the parole board that it's a little bit more nuanced than that in terms of the sorts of violence. I would say it's a sort of indictable level high court sort of violence that we're really sort of concerned about. Nobody seems to have disagreed with me in relation to that as a narrative, and from that point of view, it again becomes a really low bar. And if you can demonstrate, for example, an individual who doesn't have a pervasive pattern of violence, who's committed the murder, has been in custody for 20 years, there's been no violence, there have been things that maybe have triggered risk in terms of that they've maybe continued using substances in custody, but still it hasn't triggered violence, you can find these individuals actually being looked on fairly favourably for parole, because mm-hmm. there's an indication that they might not really be acting in that way. But it's difficult. It's difficult. You don't know who's the right person in that regard. One case is different from every other case because the risks are different for each individual. The circumstances are different. But there are these sort of things that need to be considered, and it's not just as simple as going up and saying, oh, he wants out. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned there that it's difficult. Yeah, it's maybe different for the three different categories of people that you've mentioned, or three different categories of sentences that you've mentioned. But why specifically is it difficult? Is it about presenting the right story? Is it about gathering all of the evidence? Is it about the way that you present the story? Is it about the sort of the vagaries about who happens to be on the board on the day? You know, what are the different factors which make it difficult?
Probably all of the above, but the starting point to some extent is what progress the individual has made in custody. And the difficulty at this moment in time is people making progress in custody. Whilst it's not a tick box exercise and should never be, there are certain things that a parole board might reasonably expect somebody to do before being considered a successful parole. Mm-hmm. And that would be behaving oneself, not taking drugs, not picking up reports, the basics, compliance with the regime, doing what's required of you and doing it with good grace in that sense. But then there's the other things, which is addressing your sort of your needs in terms of risk and sort of those offence specific needs and the ability to get assessments completed, very slow at the moment. Ability to get onto programmes, very slow at the moment, in particular for, actually there's now sort of two categories, I suppose, of prisoners, but it used to be just sex offenders who really struggled to get offence-focused work, but now it seems to be broadly everybody, and those who are convicted of quite serious violence find it difficult getting onto the programme. So if you've not done your programmes and you're coming up for parole, you're sort of already one step back. But the parole board, in order to meet the legal test, you don't need to do all these things in that sense.
Theoretically, you shouldn't, yeah.
In theory, you shouldn't have to do all these things because some people might need to do it, some people might not. So again, it's case specific, but most people you'd want to anticipate that they've completed their programmes or been assessed as not requiring any programmes and signed off. But then it's the sort of the next thought process of progression. Does somebody need to, as a life prisoner, for example, do you need to go to national top end? Do you need to go to the open estate? Do you have to have community access before you're released? And again, some of my submissions are based on that isn't part of the legal test. You don't need to do that. It's recognised by the court that that's not part of the legal test. Not everybody needs to do it. But however, how do you demonstrate that your risk is capable of being in the community without having that opportunity to actually demonstrate? And in some circumstances, you can quite readily see why somebody might not need to do that. There's other ways in which to demonstrate that they're capable of doing that. But equally so, you can see individuals, you say, well, actually, you probably need to go and do that. And you can understand why the parole board said, well, actually, no, we want to see you doing that. But again, that's a laborious process. I mean, we talk about it with life prisoners of a four-year window, essentially 2 years national top end, 2 years open. But it's 3 to 4 years, and in amongst all of that, there are delays for various paperwork and assessments and things to be carried out. So those sort of things sort of drag out. So from that point of view, it becomes, the process becomes difficult for somebody. They spend longer in custody. I mean, they talk about life prisoners, longer in custody because they can't get those opportunities as quickly as they might want. Because the parole board might say to somebody, listen, see if you can get some community access, we'll let you out. But the difficulty is it might take 18 months to get that community access. So there's that. So there's the fact that you have to build the evidence, and the evidence might not be there, and the evidence might be there. again, this is not to be critical of social work, but I think there is a fear of suggesting somebody should be released without them having gone through the whole process, a fear of criticism. And where, I don't know where that fear comes from, whether it's because they have been criticised at parole hearings or whether it is that they are risk averse or whether that's the training, I don't know. But it often seems as though that everything has to be done before it be agreed to. So there are lots of people, again, who are released against the recommendations of social work. And that's where, I suppose, some skills of being the solicitor and asking the right questions and highlighting the positives in the case rather than focusing on the negatives in that sense. So there's a wee bit of that that goes on, which is that if we were more honest about people's risk and it wasn't just an algorithm of ticking, you've not done this, you've not done that, you might be able to identify the people who could in fact spend less time in custody. I think from the parole board's point of view, it's a human decision.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I genuinely think that no matter how hard you try to wake up in the morning and say, okay, today is going to be a positive day, if there's something negative going on, it might influence it. It might be as simple as yesterday we let somebody out, or a month ago we let somebody out in similar circumstances, then today we've discovered the recall to custody and they've committed a significant further offence. Where did we go wrong? Yeah. You become risk averse by as a result of that. And so from that point of view, I think that, as I say, it's a human decision, and you can't be critical of anybody for that, but
you've got to recognise it for what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, but equally so, it's a human decision from the point of view, is again, if you are telling the right story, it will hit a chord.
It can also go the other way.
It can also work in your favour. I also think that I think culturally we are risk averse. We are afraid of the red top newspapers. Yeah. We are afraid. Yeah. We are afraid of it going wrong and somebody having to carry the can for it. And it shouldn't be like that, but it is.
And it goes from all levels, right? Sort of politically, societally, but then organisationally, and then the individuals working within the organisation they don't want to be the one who's made the decision, you know, which then turned out, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, let's say from an SPS point of view, they have over the years, I suppose, had high-profile failures, and they've always looked into them, they've always adapted, and they've always sort of adjusted to try and make their systems of risk management more robust. But ultimately, some of the decisions come down to, whilst they look like the collegiate decisions of the RMT, it comes down to one individual, probably being the deputy governor, saying, actually, we're going to go with this. But I've always thought, somebody has to make a decision, but the overall arching SPS Scottish ministers should always rally round behind these people to encourage them to make the best decisions they can without fear of it going wrong, and that they should know that there wouldn't be finger pointing and such.
Exactly.
Like.
Yeah.
I know it's unfair in a way to place it on the shoulders of one individual or for them to feel like that. Yeah.
And I think that's where stagnation occurs in the processes in the SPS, is because they become risk averse, and or somebody's probing around, sort of asking the right or the wrong question, and it makes them worry. And when in fact they should say, I think I've said this before in other forums, what the SPS don't do very well is highlight the good that they do, because they do lots of things very, very well. They do lots of things very badly, in my view. They do lots of things very, very well when it comes to trying to, families, for example, trying to keep contact with families. They do excellent work in these things. They do excellent work in terms of getting prisoners educated and things like that. They do really well, but they don't highlight that enough for themselves, I think, and they get bogged down in the things that probably aren't as concerning as they might think they are.
So turning now to sort of when people are in the community and the license conditions that the parole board often place on them, what are your views on the license conditions placed on prisoners in Scotland? do you think they're kind of broadly fair? Are they realistic for people in those circumstances?
There's been a journey that the parole board has gone on in terms of licensing conditions. I think this sort of, during my time, they've become clearer, but also have possibly become more restrictive. There used to be a condition that you must, for example, tell your supervising officer about new and emerging relationships, domestic violence, backgrounds, for example. And because they are wanting to protect any new partner, you then found yourself for many years arguing about what's a relationship. Was a dictionary definition of a relationship? But now the condition is written in such a way that there is no doubt about it. Actually, the people we want to know about are everybody. So we want to know who your friends are, want to know who your family are. Our relationships are no longer necessarily just intimate relationships. They're now about all your relationships. So there's an example of how we've come from a condition which was really just to protect a new partner or intimate relationship to now actually getting a whole host of things covered. But is that overly restrictive? Possibly. Does it hopefully foster a bit of openness and honesty between the individuals on licence and supervising officer? Hopefully. Does it allow the supervising officer to have a better knowledge of who they're spending their time with and what they're doing in order to ensure that risk can be managed? It probably does. Is that proportionate and necessary? It's certainly helpful. Proportionate in some cases might not be necessary, but it would be seem reasonable enough.
Do you think that, how would that be viewed by the individual under supervision, though? You said that there's an opportunity for that more expansive understanding of that person's life, like all of the sort of network of relationships that they're in, you know, for that to be on the table and have to be disclosed and discussed and everything. Do you think that that would feel like an opportunity to build a relationship with their supervising officer, or do you think it would feel like a sort of unreasonable level of surveillance from the individual?
It depends who the person is. You or I may consider that if you are unlicensed, that it might be reasonable for there to be an understanding of who you are spending your time with. Whether that is because you've committed a sexual offence, whether that is because in the past you've had a chronic substance use issue, whether drugs or alcohol, whether that is because you've been involved in organised crime and been supplying drugs. You might think it's reasonable to have that understanding. And some individuals who are released on licence are perfectly content to share all the details of their lives. Others, on the other hand, are not, and are deeply concerned about the level of information that people are going to have. And you have to question whether that is because they want to be non-compliant, or that they want to be able to try and get up to things and not be caught out, or is it because they have a deep-rooted mistrust in authority, which can't be criticised, because often these individuals have been involved with the state from a very young age. Mm-hmm. Whether it is that at an early age their parents have been committing crimes and children's and family social work have had to have an involvement with them, whether they've become unruly and then have to be involved in the sort of the children's panel process in that sense. So from that point of view, it's about trying to understand the why somebody might not want to have. Because in one view, yes, it is intrusive, and there should be some things that might be considered as private. But another sense, and the flippant remark might be, is you have a choice. You either spend the remainder of your time in custody, or you do what's required of in the community. What do you want to choose to do? Does it build a relationship with supervising officer? Yeah, I think that at a basic level it allows people to start talking about what people are doing. What have you done this week? Oh, not much, because that might be true. I've not done much because I don't have much money. I don't have a job. I don't have anything going on in my life because I've not yet built up those networks. So it allows the next question to be, okay, who did you see? Right?
Yeah.
Well, I saw my family. Did you see anybody else? Oh yeah, I saw whoever. Oh, who's that? What were you doing with them? Did you plan to spend some time with them? So it allows for a discussion. I think it allows for an openness of a discussion of this is what I've got up to this week. It allows, because that's what you want to know. You want to know how people are spending their time. And it's not to catch them out, because I think one of the questions I ask of social workers is, why is it, for example, license conditions or a risk management plan in the community won't pick up on emerging risk factors swiftly enough for them to be addressed? And you want to try and identify whether the person who's maybe got some mental health difficulties, are they isolating themselves? Have they actually been out of their house this week? Have they, for example, bumped into somebody who might be known to social work and think, well, actually, that's not really a good friendship to be having, because that might lead them back into substance misuse. So it allows for these discussions to take place to try and identify if any risks are coming to the fore, whether they might be coming to the fore in the future if something continues. But even just basic welfare in that sense. So, because ultimately the relationship with the supervising officer is really important. If it can be open and honest and there can be a trust there, if something goes wrong, you want them to pick up the phone to their supervising officer and say, this just happened, I don't know what to do. Rather than the supervising officer finding out 2-3 weeks down the line when it's all gone wrong, it's all unravelled, and in fact, you have to then consider recalling somebody to custody, for example. So conditions can be intrusive. But in the main, they're probably necessary just to give social work the tools they need to have those discussions and try and help with an open discussion about risk and how people are spending their time.
And I suppose that leads on to my final question, which is, you've highlighted some of them, but in terms of how these conditions operate in practice, then are there any kind of problems associated with that? Or, you know, the theory might be good, but how do they operate in practice, do you think?
I suppose my concerns about license conditions is sort of policing them. There needs to be a sort of uniformity of how it's done. And this isn't a criticism of social work, but some may stick to the condition to the absolute letter. I think social work sometimes need to be reminded that, in fact, there is a discretion in license conditions and they can do certain things. So, for example, if there's a curfew in place, the social work doesn't need to be rigid about that. They can say, well, actually, I can say the curfew is something different because the license conditions actually allow me to do it. I don't need to go back to ask the parole board every time there's something needing done. And that kind of leads on to sort of this idea that, and I think this is how the parole board view it, the parole board fix the license conditions. And every license condition has the discretion of the supervising officer. I think some supervising officers, social workers, understand that. Others don't seem to understand that and feel that they need to go back to the parole board to ask for things to be changed. So, for example, if we talk about, you know, electronic monitoring, the electronic monitoring only needs to stay in place as long as the supervising officer considers that it needs to be. The condition doesn't actually require to be removed from the license. And in fact, it seemed to me to be foolish to say, actually, we want to remove electronic monitoring from the license, because at some point in the future, you might want to say, actually, you've started associating with somebody in the hours of darkness. That's not good for you. And we want to put that condition back in place. So there's a discretion there.
Yeah.
In the same way as the condition regarding not approaching and contacting victims comes very clearly, unless the supervising officer says you can. And often nobody wants to have contact with the victim, but if the next event relates to family and that family want to have that contact, that's something that has to be worked through. But it gives the discretion to the supervising officer, or maybe children's and families of involving a child, to work through that. And they say, okay, we're going to do that. But it also allows them, if they try and it doesn't work, to say, no, we're going back. You're not seeing that person any longer. But again, I got a phone call yesterday. Somebody wants to see their brother. There's a condition not allowing them to see their brother. There's good reason for them not to see them. There's good reasons why they should see each other at the moment. And it's, oh, we need to ask the parole board. It's like, no, you don't need to ask the parole board. You have the discretion. Yeah. You risk assess the situation. You set the parameters of how it's going to take place. And if it works, great. If it doesn't work, you can just say, no, you're not. That's not happening. So that's my concern in terms of policing it. I also think that in terms of policing it is that it's a tolerance level. I think there are some supervising officers who have somebody relapse into substance misuse are willing to try and fix that problem.
Right, yeah.
They're willing to work with somebody. Say, if we know about it, we'll try and fix it. They say it in evidence. If we know about the problem, we'll try and fix it. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily result in a recall to custody. And there's it's a double-edged sword, because I think that's the approach that should be taken. But the difficulty is that often telling the parole board takes that decision out of the hands, and they maybe see something in terms of risk that actually say, well, actually, maybe we shouldn't do that. That's not a good idea. Mm. And I've seen it work to good effect, that people manage to get back into recovery, have a relapse, get back into recovery, everything goes fine. And great, they didn't have to go back into custody, and that didn't disrupt housing and all the other positive things that were going on in the individual's life. But I have also seen where an attempt has been made to resolve the issue of substance misuse, and it has ended up in further significant offending. And that's again where people become risk averse. Do I give people, who do I give the opportunity to, or who do I work with? Am I confident in what I'm actually saying? Or do I actually say that everybody who is caught out taking drugs needs to be reported to the parole board? It's a difficult call, and again, it comes back to what we talked about earlier on. People don't want to be personally responsible for the decisions that they make. Oh, people want to be personally responsible for the decisions they make. They just don't want to be held accountable for things when it goes wrong, in that sense. And it's easier to make the
err on the side of caution from their point of view.
There
are so many further questions that I'd like to ask. It's such an interesting conversation, but we have run out of time, unfortunately, so we'll draw it to a close there. But I want to thank you most sincerely for your time and your insights. Really interesting to hear your views. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced to accompany the textbook Criminal Justice in Scotland by Jamie Buchan, Sarah Anderson and Katrina Morrison, published by Routledge. Many thanks to James Smith for speaking to us, and to Edinburgh Napier University and the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research for their support and advice. The interview was by Katrina Morrison. Jamie Buchan produced the episode.